Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com.
You have goals. Reach them fast with IU Online's accelerated degree programs. Our 6 and 8 week courses are taught 100% online and can fit any schedule. Advance your career with a bachelor's in business administration. It only takes 10 minutes to apply. Earn an Indiana University degree that's valued around the world. Get started today at IU Online.
This week's Acquirers podcast is brought to you by my good friends at Validia. Validia runs quantitative stock selection models using factor-based strategies from 22 published books and academic research papers with long-term track records of success. Validia has combed through books about historically successful investors such as Warren Buffett, Ben Graham, and Peter Lynch, and academic research papers that contain unique investment strategies and uses them to run model portfolios it has tracked since 2003. You may recognize Validia since two of its founders, Jack Forehand and Justin Carboneau, both good friends of mine, have appeared as guests on the podcast. Through the end of February, Validia is offering 33% off an annual subscription to both its standard and professional product to listeners of the Acquirers podcast. To find out more about Validia or to take a free trial, you can go to validia.com/Toby. Again, that's validia.com/Toby. Hi, I'm Tobias Carlisle. This is the Acquirers podcast. My special guest today is Drew Dixon of Albert Bridge. We're going to be talking about his Alpha Europe strategy, studying at the Chicago Graduate School of Business under some of the biggest names in behavioral and efficient markets theory right after this.
Tobias Carlisle is the founder and principal of Acquirers Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquirers Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquirers Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquirersfunds.com.
First job out of college was commodities.
Yeah, I was basically working with a group in Atlanta, Georgia. We did risk management work for folks that had exposure to commodity prices. The bulk of the business was for grain elevators in the Midwest. These would have been farmers and grain elevators, or mostly elevators that had exposure to corn, beans, or wheat prices that they posted for farmers. And so they're sort of long or shorts, depending on which side they're on. And we helped them analyze the price risk they had. But my boss was, at the time, wanted to do the same thing in the energy markets, the oil markets. And that's when I came down there. Didn't know anything, but started working with him to sort of basically help oil companies and jobbers and wholesalers and retailers to take a look through their balance sheet and see where they might be impacted by price volatility. The classic one could be a refiner who's buying crude and selling products, and then he's got this crack spread risk. And it was pretty national. It was pretty early days for the NYMEX back then. This is the early 90s. And so I'm learning myself, obviously, but a lot of education for some relatively sophisticated companies who hadn't really used, did a lot of OTC stuff, but not a lot in the futures market. And it was all, you know, the basis trading principles you have in the traditional sort of commodities. You had in oil and in unleaded gas, heating oil, and then natural gas subsequently came on. So I spent 6 years doing that with him, but always had this passion, obviously for financial markets, but for stocks and for stock picking. And going back to my time at Purdue, I was there during the whole sort of 87 happened right in the middle of my sort of experience. And I you know, started investment clubs with my buddies, and I was writing investor newsletters and always been really just interested in the way financial markets work, particularly equity markets. And we had at the Purdue Prenter Library, there was an old copy of Security Analysis, an original one. I should have lifted it, but I checked that out and everything I can get my hands on. And I always had a passion for that. And so after, you know, doing the commodity trading sort of off the floor, I really wanted to get back into more sort of take my career in sort of the equity side of markets again. I spent a bit of time out in Korea before going to business school, but for me, that was where the I was really started to put things together in terms of how I wanted to think. I'm still learning, but was just very intrigued by this whole, at the time, this emerging sort of conflict between efficient markets and behavioral finance. And I was reading everything I could about the psychology of markets and at the same time, really sort of had an appreciation for the rigor of what the efficient market guys were doing. And so for me, the only choice to try to get into business school was at the University of Chicago, where Gene Fama was there and Merton Miller was still alive. And there was this upstart, slightly younger economist that was up in Cornell who had been poking holes in the efficient market theory. There's Bob Shiller, but this is Richard Thaler. And Fama famously was really intrigued by these guys attacking these notions of what drives the value premium, what drives returns, and how rational are markets. And Gene said to Merton Miller, who was the king of the school, I think we need to get that Thaler guy down here and make him part of the faculty. And Mert says, well, Gene, I'll let the next generation make their own mistakes. So with that, Fama made sure that Dick came down. And from, that was in, I think, 95, 96, maybe it was 94, before I got there. But it's just been fascinating. And it was fascinating watching the two of them, complete opposite sides of the spectrum. Good friends, tennis buddies, golf buddies. They play at Beverly together. But they just go at it over these notions of what drives share prices and can you beat markets or can you not? And there's actually a lot more agreement there than people realize, but there's also a lot of disagreement. But I wanted to try to get into, be a part of that and learn what I could. So that was
it's very open-minded of Fama to have invited probably his greatest critic to come and work with him and to learn from him.
Well, he was that way. I mean, and Cliff Asness will tell you that when he was a PhD student, again, before my time, he wrote one of the early papers on momentum. This was long before Mark Carhart had added it as a fourth factor to the models. And I can't remember if it was, I'm spacing out, if it was LSV or who it was that wrote the initial momentum paper. But Asness had written the same PhD paper just saying, hey, look, I'm seeing this weird stuff where stocks have gone up over the last 12 months keep going up and stocks that went down over the last 12 keep going down, and did the proper work on it and proposed it to Gene. And Gene said, well, if it's in the data, write the paper. He was, he's open to criticism and that's the one anomaly that he really struggles with even today. He's just like, I don't know what this compensation for. I mean, he can come up with a story for value. And we can have debates about, is it the behavioral or the risk explanation? But that momentum one, that's a tough one to come up with from an efficient market perspective. Is it being some compensation for, maybe it's a discontinuous jump risk that you might get one day, and so you need to be paid for that in the meantime. But I think it's kind of a lame post hoc look back reason why factors should work. I think it needs to be a sort of state variable, kind of in the spirit of Bob Merton, this sort of ICAPM stuff. If you want to have an efficient market story for why value works, well, it has to be compensation for a risk you're taking, or for that matter, small caps or market exposures. And then the behavior explanation is, hey, now this has nothing to do with the compensation for risk. This is due to glamour versus value sort of anchoring and excitedness and hurting and all these behavioral factors that impact the way people make decisions. So I ended up, a little bit more philosophically aligned with Thaler. But I got to say, I'm still learning today about finance because of Fama. He just teaches you how to think. It was a great experience.
How do you go from, the old GSB, now it's called Booth, probably the best quant school in the States, maybe in the world. You've got some of the biggest names on the efficient market side, also on the behavioral side. How do you get from there? You're not a quant in your approach, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm intrigued by the notions of it all. But at the heart of it, I'm more interested in sort of the idiosyncratic firm-specific side of what it is stock pickers do. And now I do think that it's a little bit more difficult at a specific company level, but it's, I think it's still practical or practicable. You know, some of these same reasons that's to help explain why there are opportunities, these behavioral sort of overreactions, these underreactions, the underreaction thing that drives momentum. You know, effectively what it is in my mind, it's people underreacting to changes in the business model. And so as more people become, you know, cotton on as the narrative changes, this is one of the things that helps to explain why momentum works over the long run. People don't like to process information which is different than their existing view, the confirmation bias thing. And I think you can apply that at a company level as well. It's more difficult. A lot of other things are introduced when you do that. But for me, if we can do that deep dive, fundamental research, trying to understand what a business model looks like, who's running it, what the policies are for managing their capital, and then try to develop a view of not only is our view different from what the market thinks in terms of what the business might look like in 2 or 3 years, but why?
Right.
That's the big one. Because you can always say, oh, I'm building a model. Look, I'm 20% ahead of the street. But anyone could do that. I mean, you just, if you already have a pre-existing notion, you like this company, you'll come up with whatever you want. And the more complicated the model you're using, the easier it is to get to the number you want. So I one of my blog posts I wrote about, you know, the DCF being the Randy Watson of valuation. Randy Watson was the singer in Coming to America One, which Eddie Murphy said was good and terrible. And that's what, to me, the DCF is. It's perfect. It is the perfect tool for a completely unbiased mind. But if you introduce any notions of bias into your analysis, any predilections, any sort of disdain or belief in the management team, you can make that model sing, baby, and you can spit out whatever number you want. And so I try to sort of make, you know, try to use proxies for the DCF that might be a little less biased, and you can have a debate about what they might be, but, and in some cases, I think it's different for different companies. Some companies, it's, they're going to be much more driven, depending on the balance sheet, by EV metrics. Some will be driven by some of the parts value. Basically, what do we think the market will think? That's kind of our, it's a bit of a Keynesian beauty contest analysis, but what do we think the market will think about this company in 2 years? And how different is that than what the market thinks now? And if we can spot herding, confirmation bias, anchoring, something which is explaining why they're not reacting to how positive things are, or overreacting in the short term to how negative things are. I mean, as we worked through the pandemic, a lot of what we were doing was more of that sort of, I'm getting ahead of myself in the whole career thing, but a lot of what we're doing is, okay, hey, this stock should be down 20%. This thing is heavily levered. It's going to see a trough. They're going to have to refinance some debt because the markets are closed, and that should put some pressure on things. So it should be down 20, not 70, but 20. So we found ourselves selling things that were only down, you know, 20 to buy things down 70 kind of behavior. But anyway, that's getting ahead of things. So back to Chicago. Yeah, that's that was a great foundation for me. And I stayed pretty close and still have with Dick over the years and continue to learn from him. And my whole goal is to try to merge the behavioral with the fundamental as we think about stock picking.
When did you get to OxIF?
I started off at Fidelity right after business school. I'd spent a summer in Hong Kong with them and then full-time in London. I moved there in 99. And then 3 years later, I joined OxIF. And that was my introduction to long short. And at the time, they've gone through their surge and their fall and perhaps recovery now. But at the time, it was much more of an RV shop, much more merger arbitrage place that was it was becoming more of a multi-strategy firm at the time. And so I came in to sort of do more traditional equity stock picking, whereas most of the desk was more focused on some of the M&A sort of stuff. And great experience, just seeing, you know, at Fidelity, you're driving this super tanker, right? You're massive and you own 10% of a company. And if you want to change your mind about it, it's hard to. And if it's hard to change your mind, I think that's a little bit poisonous. That could be something that prevents you from doing the right work. And so that helped to shake me, that, you know, this sort of notion of, and I think it also helped having been a commodity trader beforehand, and that selling first and buying second, that wasn't something I had to unlearn. And that was just natural to me. So it did, whichever order you were doing it, didn't matter. And so, you know, to me, any stock, and even Ben Graham said this, that, you know, in Security Analysis, or maybe it was Intelligent Investor, any stock price can be dear in one range and cheap in another. Which is interesting to see in the environment we're in now, where people just think you buy good stocks, they go up forever. This whole quality compounding discussion we've been having for 3 or 4 years that's accelerated in the last 12 months. But I really do believe that any stock can be a buy, any stock can be a sell. There is a difference between price and value. And that's kind of the job of, you know, if I'm good at that, or if any of my peers are good at that, that can be a great thing for a portfolio. If we're not, or if I'm not, that money should be in an index fund. And, you know, if you want your factor exposures to, if you don't want any factor exposures, fine. If you do want to have exposures to value, quality, and momentum, or in the last year, not value, anti-momentum, or sorry, not value, and for some periods, not momentum, that's your decision. But this residual in the regression equation, this alpha that we're all trying to capture, that is the goal. And to the extent that the world has evolved to sort of be able to provide some of these, like Prince, the artist formerly known as Prince, you've got this thing that the formerly known as alpha thing, which we can get now, you can get in a value factor fund. You can get it with Cliff's products at AQR, a host of these guys that do great work. And is there anything left after that? Is there anything left? Is there idiosyncratic risk in the academic sense? Is there firm specific risk that you can take advantage of? And my answer, obviously I'm biased. I do this for a living. So I think the answer is yes. But I will say that to do so, there are limited and rare opportunities where there is that kind of obvious sort of mismatch. I don't think you can capture a whole lot of alpha in a big diversified portfolio. You can capture factor risks, and if you want to call that factor betas instead of alpha, the artist formerly known as, that's fine. It's probably what they are. I do think that a lot of factors that people look at, you know, going beyond the value, going beyond momentum, going beyond size, which is a debatable one itself. A lot of times people will call something a factor sort of in hindsight, this sort of after the fact. Well, this all worked and this all worked at the same time. That's a factor. And maybe I'm just a bit too grounded in the whole theoretical notion of what factor risks are supposed to be, but they're supposed to be compensations for risk. They're supposed to be offering you something that it's a sort of state variable of hedging concern. You can hedge it out if you want to. The fact that betting against beta works. What's the theoretical one for that? What's the behavioral one for that? I don't have an explanation for it. But I'm pretty comfortable, and at least, you know, not during all regimes, but I'm pretty comfortable believing that it's actually behavioral dynamics that drive momentum. It's behavioral dynamics that drive value or growth. And less so behavioral on the size stuff. That could be a liquidity risk thing. But back to your question, no, I don't, I want to be fully aware of what those factor exposures I'm taking, and also philosophically focused on what remains as what we can try to capture. And to do so, though, it must be in a concentrated, I mean, in my view, it must be a very concentrated portfolio, which brings risk, right? This thing will naturally have periods of deep downdrafts. But over time, if there is alpha to extract, it can't be done from a diversified portfolio. Let's talk mathematically.
Let's talk a little bit about Albert Bridge. How do you characterize the philosophy there, and then how is that expressed in the strategy or strategies?
Yeah, well, it's basically it's a process that, given we try to be bottom up, we try to be firm specific. We try purposefully not to take a top down view about anything. Even within factors, I'll tweet out a lot of things or some things. Hey, look at how much growth outperformed value. It hasn't happened like this since 98, 99, blah, blah, blah. But broadly, we're going to have a value bias, but it's not like what you might have, Toby, this super deep value bias that's sort of really dive in and buy the stuff that has a big margin of safety. And for us, it's almost this 2 to 3 year window. Okay, what can we own today where a business that's either not deteriorating as much as people think, or it's improving more than people think, or maybe it's even turning, that the market doesn't want to see yet, that the market will have a completely different view about in a few years' time. And that's one aspect of it. So you've got to break that down into the fundamental part, the behavioral part, and the fundamental part. And this is sort of just falling from the way we did things at Fidelity. You just do a deep dive. You speak to the management, the CEO, the CFO, you do plant tours and visits, and you learn about the sector and all that, everything you need to know. But then you realize that you're one of a gazillion people doing the same thing. And sometimes you'll see folks that, think they have the inside edge because they just met with management. And I think that's kind of naive. I think you've got to realize that, you're one of many sell side and buy side analysts doing the same thing. And I think the real value added for us and for anyone who's picking stocks is to see what you can pick out of that sort of avalanche of information and see if any of it actually matters to the investment thesis. And with that, we'll try to do a pretty rigorous modeling of those key factors, whatever they are. It could be certain products, it could be spinoffs of businesses, it could be within a software company, a maintenance line. How much, what's happening? Is that accelerating, deteriorating? Let's look at the licenses are translating to that. What it means is it spills down and whatever we think the market will think is the thing that drives value. That's what we try to focus on. And if we have to be a little bit ahead of the market in that, where we think they'll go in their thinking, we can then marry that sort of deep fundamental dive to this, whatever behavioral bias we think is being committed. Is it a representative bias? Is it an availability bias? Is it something that is preventing people from seeing that this business might look very different to everybody in 2 or 3 years. And those things are exciting. They're wobbly, they're volatile, but they're exciting. And so the goal for the Alpha Europe process is to focus on sectors which are less macro exposed. Now, you're still going to have macro exposures everywhere, industrials, even technology, but broadly, they're a little more secular, a little more stern, firm specific than, say, utilities or real estate or defensives, these things that are going to go ebb and flow more with this market appetite for that kind of stock. Whereas you can find winners and losers within the healthcare equipment space or within media or technology or industrials pretty easily. Not easily, you can identify them. It's going to be dispersion of returns, and that gives you the chance to do stock picking. So we focus on those groups and try to gel it up to a portfolio. Or actually to a focus list first of sort of things that look really interesting and dynamic. And then we sort of start this de-biasing process. Okay, what can we do to sort of make sure we're not being affected ourselves? And we're not immune just because we know about behavioral finance or studied under Richard Thaler. Danny Kahneman will say himself, I came up with all these things. I still commit the same errors. It's just because you know about them doesn't mean you can prevent them. So what can we do ourselves to sort of insulate our emotions and recognize at least that we're biased people, biased analysts, biased PM? Well, we can write short cases on everything we want to buy, like not just the sort of quote unquote one paragraph. These are the risks to the long case, but the deep dive short case, and how are you going to make money on this thing on the short side? And I should say that, backing things up, when we launched Alpha Europe back in 2008, our main product was a long short fund. And then we were bought by Perella Weinberg in 2012, it was, and pretty quickly launched a long only fund alongside it. And then as we spun off Perella's platform to launch Albert Bridge back in 2016, it was a long only fund that we led with. And, but still bringing those long short principles, I think, helps. And so if we can come in there and build, we call them shadow models or black sky models. Okay, here's the business that we think has got great ROICs and they're going to beat numbers and no one's paying attention because this, this, and this. And okay, now flip yourself around and represent the defense and tell me why this thing's a dog and why it's going to go lower and what's going to happen. And it's a great debiasing exercise. And each of those, so each that work for both, you know, both the long and the short work on each of these names become sort of our constraints, sort of, okay, well, if we're right about company XYZ or XYZ, as you might say in Australia, or we would say in England, we can then say, okay, if we're broadly right about what this stock will be worth, if we're right, and if we're broadly right about what the stock will be worth if we're wrong, then we can start to develop this notion of risk and reward. We can start to develop this notion of expected returns. And then we could ask ourselves, okay, well, how long is this going to take for the market to wake up to this thesis? Is it going to take a year? Is it going to take 2 years? How volatile is this thing naturally? We should penalize it if it's naturally more volatile. And we could put all these things into a mix. And then effectively, using a bit of Kelly criterion math, come up with the right size we think these positions should be. And obviously that's going to be somewhat dependent on the expected returns of the other things that we've found that have gelled up. But then the goal for us is to basically get a 15-20 stock portfolio. And then within that portfolio, and this isn't a long only portfolio, within that portfolio, just by the nature of those expected returns, typically get 35 to 50% of the AUM in the top five positions. And their duration in the portfolio will be a function of not only how the fundamentals do develop over the next few years, but also just their own volatility. That stocks could, you know, they can go up to, you know, Goldman Sachs upgrades a stock and it rallies 12% over 3 days. Well, we lost a bit of the expected return that we might even trim some of that, wait for it to find its equilibrium later and add back to it. So this sort of stock selection, the managing of the positions and just and then the sizing of them, all those things are sort of factors that help contribute to this alpha proposal. And for us, it's basically since 2010. It's a tough time to be a value investor. You've been talking about this every podcast, right? So. And we've been really proud of being able to outperform the markets, despite us not owning any Tesla or anything remotely close to it. Then that would have been impossible if I had a 75 stock book. It really needs to be concentrated. It needs to be high conviction, deep dive stuff, especially because you want to be able to hold on to it when everything does hit the fan, right? You really can't, and you also want to be able to say, hey, I screwed this up, and have a culture where you can mess things up. That's another key debiasing tool. It's kind of jumping all over the place here, but you know, you want your analysts, you want yourself to sort of, you know, not to the RWSB point of sort of posting your losses and saying how great they are, but certainly to the point of being able to say, no, I messed this one up. And this is a big thing. I use a lot of baseball analogies in the UK, and you've been in the US long enough, you'll get them, but they're lost a bit when I talk to our British investors, but it's not just a batting average game. It's a slugging percentage game, right? And we're going to have all these sort of ways to sort of try to get that batting average up. So get more stocks right than you get wrong. But within those ones that you get right, you have this notion of impact. This, you know, and for us, you know, for things that whether it's, you know, either make money or lose money relatively or absolutely, we're sort of, it's kind of a mid 50s sort of hit rate, batting average, if you will. But if you look at the things that had more than 100 basis points impact, or more than 200 basis points impact, or more than 300 basis points of impact over the last however many years, that batting average becomes a slugging percentage, and it gets up into the 60s and the 70s, which is what we want to see. And so we throw all that stuff in the mix in terms of how we size the positions and have this culture where, because we've written that short note, we're looking for the bad stuff. And if we see the bad stuff, you just hold your hand up and say, hey, this is one of those 4 out of 10 that we're going to screw up. And it's one of those things that kind of offsets that whole Kahneman-Tversky loss aversion thing. If it's okay to have a loss, it's no fun, especially if you've been public about it. If your investors know it's a big idea and you think you're smart because you picked the right stock, you don't want to find information which makes you look stupid. But that's kind of what we should do. So have that process and make it okay to make those mistakes.
What's your universe in terms? So it's Europe, but is it anywhere in Europe? And then do you care about sort of your geographic concentration or diversification, or that's just an irrelevant consideration?
Well, it may not be irrelevant, but I don't care. I don't care about, we're basically a Western European focused product. So we'll have, it depends on what ideas make their way through the process and through our universe into this focus list. But we'll typically have a lot of exposure in the UK or Germany, France, sometimes in Sweden, Norway, Finland, Spain, very little in Portugal or Austria, a bit in Holland, a bit in Italy. Just depends on the ideas and the nature of them. But no, we're not... arguably, it's become less important after we all moved to the euro, but you know, in terms of FX risk. But from a geographic perspective, we monitor it, but we don't have any constraints on it. If it turns out that we have half the portfolio in one country, as long as we think we're doing things that are idiosyncratic and they're not that related to each other, we're totally fine with it. And similarly, you say the same thing about our sector exposures. We've got a lot of consumer stuff. We have a lot of industrial stuff, very little in tech in Europe. We haven't found things we thought that we had a few IT services exposures over the years where we thought people are missing out on things.
What's the limiting there? Yeah, you just don't think that they're cheap enough. They're just not underfollowed enough.
There are some that are, but you don't have these sort of global dominating kind of businesses in tech like we have in the U.S. We had one, which we held, and this is, I mean, it's not a values talk at all, but we held it because this is a great example, actually, Toby. It was Arm Holdings, which is a company that basically they're inside all these phones. The Arm architecture is, it's a globally dominating business. SoftBank bought it a few years ago. So that kind of lost one of our potential sort of world dominating tech companies. And of course we have SAP and, you know, the big IT services companies like Capgemini and Atos and things, but, and we've had different positions in a lot of these things over the years. And I should mention too, sometimes we've had names in the portfolio for 6 months. Usually it's when we sort of get 6 months into it, we're like, no, we screwed that up. That's wrong. Sometimes it's because the thesis changed. And then sometimes there can be something in the portfolio for years. But even that is not a static size. It can be a 5% position and that can grow to 8 and fall to 4. This is all very much driven by what its expected returns are. It's like we have that here's what we're worth if it goes up. Here's what it's worth if it goes down. Where is the stock in that? And how does that compare to other things in the portfolio? And as the expected returns fall for certain things, we'll shift that capital into other things that have higher expected returns. And that drives a bit of turnover, which has a bad name, but I think it can actually be a positive thing in a concentrated book if you're doing it from without bias. Obviously, easier said than done, but that's part of the process for us too.
So how are you hunting for what you're looking for? How are you tracking them down, then how are you sort of going, what's the process for validating and making sure they fit for the portfolio?
So we start with the defined universe of $1 billion market cap companies and up in the sectors we focus on, and the analysts, including myself, will be in charge of doing the work in those groups.
How big is that universe roughly?
It's a 300 SOC universe, basically. And you can have, you know, call it five different sectors that we're, you know, focusing mostly on. Like I mentioned, we don't look at the utilities or the telecoms or the interest rate sensitive stuff, real estate. But in these stock picking sectors, these ones with the highest dispersion, it becomes a matter of, we call our process the game, gather, analyze, model, evaluate. So at the beginning of the process, you're just gathering information. You're going to conferences, you're meeting with companies, and you're just trying to hear things that you didn't expect to hear. And if you don't hear anything you didn't expect to hear, you'd move on to the next sector, the next idea. But if you hear that stuff that, hey, I didn't expect that. If you see management change its tone from what they used to say 6 months ago or a year ago, well, let me dig a little deeper to this and then move into the A state. You start to analyze all the information you've gathered, most of which the most important thing in that A stage is to get rid of information, get rid of stuff which is noisy and people are going to think it's news or it doesn't matter, and try to really hone in on the stuff that does matter. And in the M stage, we're just modeling it. Okay, what's this thing going to look like? Down the road, given the restructuring that they're doing or the products that they're launching or the margins that they're seeing or the demand that we're hearing about. And then in the E stage, the evaluation stage, we're evaluating consensus expectations. Okay, where is Mr. Market? What do they think about this? And we try not to know that stuff at first. We don't talk to sell side analysts until very end to see what their views are. We don't want to be biased ourselves. We just want to be fairly open and objective, this notion that company XYZ is a buy or it's a sell or it's a nothing. Once we decide it's something in that E stage, then we're trying to understand why. Okay, why does the market not see the things that we see? What are we getting wrong? What are they getting wrong? And if we can then marry those things, then we have candidates for the focus list. And then the whole expected return thing is what then helps me down select to a more concentrated portfolio of our very best ideas. So
when you're looking at upside and downside, if something is a potential zero, is it still potentially in the portfolio, or is it only that's never going to get a consideration, even though the upside might be so vast?
Yeah, I mean, it raises a great question, right? And I wonder if I would answer the question differently now than I would have a year ago. For my career, it's always been this notion of I don't mind asymmetry. Like theoretically, Toby, we can have situations where we think there's only a 30-40% chance of it being a winner. But if it's a three bagger, if it wins, almost call optiony, and there's only 20% downside if it doesn't win, well, you'll press forward. But typically we don't have that kind of situation. Usually it's a 60-80% conviction kind of name, where we'll have downside. The bigger balance sheets potentially have more downside if things go pear-shaped. But fast forward into the way markets can behave in these extreme periods. Like a lot of our stuff that I totally misestimated what the downside was for a lot of our names in March of 2020, right? So stuff that we thought might have fallen 30% in the worst case literally was down 60-70%. And you can mess things up on the upside too, because you want to be conservative. You don't want to look stupid. Hey, I think company XYZ could quintuple. There's no upside to saying that to your boss or to your investor, right? If you say, hey, there's great upside, look, we're ahead of the street by 25%. We think it's 80% or we think it can go up 80%. Okay, that's getting out there, but that's still reasonable. But you can't, you've got to be careful in terms of being objective yourself. And so the question becomes now, after we saw what could happen to companies in March last year, how will the market react to that as it marches forward and thinks about how to value upside and downside of certain kinds of things? Should people model for a global pandemic that will shut down the economy? And as it turns out, markets really didn't care that much about it ultimately, and which I it's still very intrigued by. And that's in a whole nother discussion, policy reaction and things like that. But it does beg the question, but what is the actual downside now that we've been introduced to this idea that economies can be ground to a halt?
it's not something that I've done any work on, but it's just something that I sort of anecdotally observed as we went through, that there were a lot of companies that had, healthy balance sheets with plenty of cash on the balance sheet. You would think that with a business that's reasonably strong through that period, it should have been, I don't want to say lower beta, but it should have moved less than the market. And then there were companies on the other side that were pretty heavily levered, weren't making any money. You would think that that would be a little bit more, volatility than the market. And it was an unusual period, because I don't think that, if anything, it was the other way around. It was some of the ones that I thought were a bit junkier didn't react as much, and some of the ones that were a little bit safer reacted more. I mean, I think Berkshire Hathaway is a pretty good example of that.
Yeah.
Just like an absolute, battleship that's just unsinkable. And then it was down more than the market.
Yeah. And that's a great point. So what I think happened with Berkshire, and actually what happened to a host of names, it's kind of depended what factor box you were in. And so, and we were even seeing that before the pandemic started. If you're in the growth mo box, you get sort of a different constituency than you're in the value anti-mo box. And it became so, I think historically sort of significant by the middle of, I guess, late March, early April, that even in our portfolio, we'll tilt value. We're not a growth shop at all. We won't own a lot of that other stuff, but we're happy to own ARM Holdings, as I mentioned back in the day. But we found ourselves tilting way more value just because it was silly. And you see it even still now. If you're in this box, you're in this meme box, or if you're in this growth box, or if you're in this FAMANG box, you have flows. And that has this sort of self-sustaining narrative until it doesn't. The parallels, and I'm sure this one's been beaten to death, but the parallels between what we're seeing now with the SPACs and the free money back in 98, 99, or the RWSB versus the sort of message boards and chat rooms, there's so many similarities to the behavior and why people want to own things. And the trick for folks to do what I do is, you have to be aware of that, right? So you're scouring your portfolio, making sure you're not short things that they might decide they love, even if it's probably a zero. But at the same time, you have to realize that ultimately, and this is the ultimate question, and I've had this debate with some good mates of mine about this notion of the voting machine or the weighing machine, this pentagram notion of how things work. And going back to this, I mentioned being at college and sort of reading everything I could. My favorite quote from him was, the market's a voting machine whereon countless individuals register their votes, partly the product of reason, partly of emotion. And that's what drives things. Part of it's reason, part of it's emotion. And that's a time varying thing, right? It's not like everyone's always crazy. And it's not like everyone's always calm, but reason's always there. And it's either a big part of things or a small part of things. And that gets us to this notion of the voting and weighing machine. Ben Hunt, Epsilon Theory, a friend of mine, he thinks it's a voting machine from here to eternity. I think that it depends. I think it eventually becomes a weighing machine. And in some cases, it becomes a weighing machine very quickly. You have a market overreact to a bad earnings print, and then it finds equilibrium. Or that could take years, but eventually we get to the fundamentals. And so then you've got to make sure you're structuring your investments, your business, so that you have that ability to weather that storm between now and then. And also, you can't be steadfast in your, just because you bought a stock and it's lost money, it doesn't mean it's necessarily going to come back. It might be a bad idea. It might be one of those 4 out of 10 that wasn't going to work. Has the thesis changed? Let's go back and read the short case. Does that actually look stronger now? Let's go back and read your buy case. And is some of those pillars to the buy foundation broken down? Just constantly be as objective as you can about it. And hopefully that makes you more clear thinking than the next guy, which is what we're trying to do.
I think it always looks like a voting machine that will never stop being a voting machine when it has been a voting machine for a long time. But that's what Lakonishik, Schlieffer, Vishny, they would say, naive extrapolation investors are always going to assume that you just continue on with this trend in earnings or stock prices or so, whatever. And then the better bet has typically been to assume that there'll be some mean reversion at some point. So I've been a little bit resistant. Michael Green also has that argument that the flows totally dominate the market now and will until there's sort of this crack up boom and then a bust, which I, you know, it's hard to argue otherwise in a market that is going to do that until it doesn't.
I know. And I had a few discussions with him as well. I disagree, but it lays out a very compelling argument about how flows are sort of the dominating feature, and that a lot of the theory that we've all learned on how things work and why they should work is inapplicable if at best from his perspective. But when I take a look at it, it is the case that ultimately, we own shares not because of some belief that we can sell them at a higher price to someone else, but because we have a belief that eventually there's cash flows and dividends, and either through share price appreciation or return of capital, that we'll decide that'll be what drives what things are ultimately worth. The question becomes, is ultimately 20 years from now, or is it 6 months from now? And obviously it's, we prefer it to be something that's quicker rather than longer, and you get that validation and you don't have as much volatility. But at the same time, I think to the point of the guys who focus more on flows, you do have to be cognizant of it. And if I were to go back and diagnose some things where my big mistakes have been, not only do I never buy the bottom, I don't think anyone does. I'm always too early. I'm always, this thing's down 12% for the stupidest reason of all time. Let me go buy a bunch of it. And then it just keeps going and going and going. And I'm letting myself think that the market's going to get reasonable and rational, and the weighing machine will show up tomorrow when it might not. It might be 6 months from now. Now, the trick is rewiring your circuits, and it's hard to do because sometimes the thing to do is to buy that stock because tomorrow the weighing machine will show up. So I think a lot of that comes back to sort of the kinds of ideas you have and how similar or in theses they are, not in terms of what the companies do, but is this an overreaction thesis? Is this an overreaction thesis, or is this an under? And that's an under. And how might they behave in different sort of market regimes? But it's interesting to watch this whole narrative thing, this whole notion that narratives are dominating and driving things. And for every GameStop that obviously was a, you just get a bunch of people on board. I think hedge funds on both sides of that were probably the bigger players than anyone wants to realize. But it was interesting to see. And then, of course, it's still 900% higher than where it was a year ago, right? But this whole move from 40 to 450 and then back to 40 or 50, wherever it is now, that all happened in this craziest week I can remember. I was involved in the Volkswagen thing back in 08. This I think felt, certainly in percentage terms, was much greater, not in terms of total. I think Volkswagen gained 300 billion euros of value in the space of 3 days. And this wasn't that big in total, but it was bigger move in percentage terms. But that was a narrative thing. Let's take it up because people believe in it. And then you had, I think, a lot of professionals who have followed that momentum and maybe played that a bit in sort of some of the short squeeze activity that we saw. I think some of the people that knew they were buying it probably didn't think it was worth what they were paying, but they'd be able to sell it higher. And you have things like Tesla, which to me, and I've written a few things about this, I've tried to de-bias myself. I've tried to come up with the most bullish sort of potential assumptions, not only for the automotive business, but trying to do it for the automotive business and then see what remains in terms of what's the market paying for the sort of Elon Musk option. And I think, I don't want to say it's a GameStop because they've got real business. They have real things that they do, but it's the narrative that's driving that one too. It's just, but it just continues. It's so strong. It's so powerful. So much so that when Elon tweets out, he likes Bitcoin or GameStop or anything, you know, it's like Matt Levine's writing a lot about this right now. It's, you know, you get here's $1 billion, whatever he says, it goes. So that stuff is, it's narrative driven. It's a bit more, some people say investing in stocks is gambling, but it's certainly a lot more like gambling than it is pure stock picking, when you're sort of guess, well, I'd be able to sell this at a higher price to someone else because the Mo's working. Some guys are very good at that. That's not my skill set. Mine is, would keep me away from owning something like Tesla, unfortunately, because I can't get there even in the most, I mean, Toyota and Volkswagen both were founded in 1937, and they're just incredible global scale businesses. And they've, after decades, have arrived at the point where they have 10% or 7% global market share, and extremely profitable. And you can make all these fast forward assumptions about EV being 90% of every car that's sold in 15 years, and you can start to flex on what kind of margins these players will have in that. You know, you look at the CapEx that Toyota itself is spending, add up all the CapEx of all the auto companies, and it's over $100 billion, and Tesla will spend four, right? So I think it's going to be a rude awakening. You've heard these arguments before, but just let's say that I'm wrong. Let's say that Tesla does become a Toyota or a Volkswagen. And let's say they become twice the company that those two, but let's say they have 20% market shares of all EVs sold, and they do net margins that are higher than what Tesla does today because of the software add-ons and things like that. Even doing that, you can't get to more than $350-400 billion market cap, which means even in that incredibly almost impossible scenario, you're paying another $600 billion for whatever it is he's going to do next. And yes, it's been great for Cathie Wood and everyone else to have bought this thing and have it rip and build a business out of it. But philosophically, I couldn't do that. So
to what extent is this driven by the option speculation, which seems to be the tail that wags a dog a little bit, where there's some delta hedging going on by the folks on the other side of that trade?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about the gamma squeeze, and sort of, and you get this whenever someone's out buying a call option, then the hedgers are going to have to go out and buy stock, the guys that sold them the stuff. Now, they sold it at a very nice bid offer spread, so these guys aren't going to be losing money when they do this. So they go out and they delta hedge, and the stock goes higher, so they got to buy a bit more of the delta. It works back the other way. I think that might have driven some of the sort of the craziness. I think what drove it more crazy than it might have been warranted is that everyone started talking about it, right? So it wasn't just the technicalities of a gamma squeeze. It was that everyone learned what a gamma squeeze was. Right. And everyone's like, people never heard the term. And they're like, son, dad, what's a gamma squeeze? Well, geez, what? So it just became this wonderful self-fulfilling feedback loop. And I think the sort of retail guys thought they were fighting the hedge funds when in fact it was probably hedge funds fighting hedge funds, and just playing the narratives, and a lot of sort of misdirection and sort of talking about front running and sort of coordination. It was just a speculative mania, which we've seen time and time again. And this time it's everyone's talking to each other in real time. And so you come up with these notions of politics or of the, you know, screwing the man, and you know let's get these hedge funds back for their bailout in 08. I'm thinking to myself, mate, hedge funds weren't bailed out in 08. It was the banks and the hedge funds found out a lot of this stuff and a lot of these sort of these egregious situations. These things, short sellers are a paragon of virtue. Yes, they can be spivvy and dodgy, some, but most are not. Most are, you know, good folks who are helping people construct portfolios that give them a little bit of uncorrelated return to the rest of what they own. They're out there making markets efficient. They're out there exposing situations so that mom and pops don't pay too much for stuff because no one's doing the work. And so there's a value that they add. And it's a tough place to have been since 2009 when everything's ripping. For those that have been able to sustain it and stay with it, it'll come back in vogue, believe me. So, as soon as markets start falling down, everyone's going to want long short again. So all the narratives that were flying around the last 2 weeks, they were just nuts. They were just crazy. And it was wild. But we're not out of the woods either. Other things are going to happen. We're in this environment now, and we could tell ourselves it's because interest rates are low and money's free. And so you can sort of discount terminal values with 100 years duration at whatever price you want and pay infinity for a thing. Or you could say that's a bit of a post hoc explanation for why things are the way they are. We had a bubble in 1999 when interest rates were 5%. That wasn't the story. It was just people got excited and psychology took off. And I do wonder if a lot of that is what's hitting us now. And the unpredictability of all that is, if it's happening now, it can, you know, if things are twice as expensive as they should be, they could become three times as expensive. But back to the voting and weighing, eventually the market weighs. And we saw that in after the tech bubble, even great companies, you know, fell 80% to where they should have been. And then they've marched higher since. And we'll see. We'll see how it all plays out. But the timing of it, who knows?
I think that's a great sentiment to leave it on, Drew. If folks want to get in contact with you or follow along with what you're doing, how do they go about doing that?
Just send us an email at info@albertbridgecapital.com.
And your Twitter account.
And folks that follow us on Twitter. And if they're interested in sort of learning more about how I think and how we think and my philosophy, we do have this Drew's Views blog on our website. I usually will post some of that stuff into Twitter as well, but it's a fun thing to scroll through and read sort of a bit about the way we think the world works in terms of stock picking, valuation, is sort of all these questions that we're having, like the impact of flows and of factor investing on stock picking and what gets squeezed out, what doesn't, and how do you make better decisions and as you go about this. It's been a cathartic thing for me to do just to write, and I enjoy doing it. But I think we've got a lot of subscribers now, and a lot of folks are enjoying and hopefully learning a bit. And I'm learning too. This whole experience of sort of trying to be a bit more out there, whether on Twitter or with our blog, it's met a lot of great people and learned a bunch myself. So it's been great. And meeting guys like you too, Toby.
On that note, Drew Dixon, Albert Bridge, thank you very much.
All right, mate. Cheers.